So now I'm going to introduce Dr. Ms. Nakato, who will talk a little bit about Archives of the Disappeared and introduce Khaled Fahmy. Hi, Mesna.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you might be dialing in from. Welcome to the Archives of the Disappeared seminar series for Easter term. Thank you so much, Hannah, for beginning the introductions. I just wanted to say a few things about Archives of the Disappeared. This is a research network based at the Center for Arts, Center for Research in the Arts, and Social Sciences and Humanities here at the University of Cambridge. It is also sponsored by Newnham College, one of the colleges at the University of Cambridge, as well as the Margaret Anstey Center for Global Studies. It is a collaborative research network between Mavish Ahmed, Yael Navarro, Hannah Morgenstern, and I, as well as colleagues from around the world, where we come together to think and ask questions and do intensive, deep readings that we've done throughout the year around a central question. How do you archive those who have been disappeared or forcibly disappeared or erased or annihilated throughout history, but in particular in the 20th century? This is a problem that animates so much of our work, and yet we find that the disciplinary methodologies that we were trained in have not been particularly helpful in allowing us to think through how we can write and conduct scholarship that seeks to think through and work on these particular questions. We are particularly focused on questions in the Middle East and South Asia. However, we engage extensively and deeply with scholarship that is based in other parts of the world and in other time periods. Without further ado, we welcome you to participate in the Archives of the Disappeared research series. We're going to we've put up now the poster, and please feel free to get in touch so that I can add you to our mailing list. Our next session is actually next Tuesday. Without further ado then, we are incredibly honored and pleased to have with us today Professor Khaled Fahmy. Professor Fahmy is based here at the University of Cambridge and as a Sultan Qaboos Professor of Modern Arab Studies. Professor Fahmy completed his doctorate at Oxford and taught at Princeton, NYU, and the American University of Cairo before he came to us here in Cambridge. His first book was on Muhammad Ali, and his current book, which we have, which we sent you the introduction first chapter to, is titled In the Quest of Justice. It lauded immensely and deservedly, and has won the American Society for Legal History's Peter Gongel Prize for the best book in non-Western legal history. It's been translated into Arabic and will hopefully be published by the end of this year. So for those of you in the Arab world, please do keep an eye on for it. So without much ado, welcome Professor Fahmy.
Thank you very much, Mesna. Let me just thank you for this wonderful introduction. Thanks, Hannah and Yael and Mavish for hosting me and for inviting me. And thanks for running this wonderful seminar that I invite everybody, encourage everybody to attend. And thanks everybody for dialing in. It's a pleasure to, I can't really see all of you, but know that you're around. I see your names. Now I'm concentrating on my screen, but earlier I could see many friendly faces from various parts of the world. So it's a pleasure to see you all. Let me just delve in, or maybe on a personal note, and to say that I've been working on the history of public hygiene and its intersection with the law, hence this book that I'm sharing one half chapter and the introduction from. This is a chapter or half a chapter on quarantines, which is something that we are living in right now. And in a sense, and specifically, when I say I've been working on public hygiene, I've been working specifically on two epidemics. One of them was a pandemic from the 19th century, the cholera epidemic of 1831 and the plague epidemic of 1834 to 35. These were particularly devastating epidemics in Cairo, I mean, throughout the world, especially the cholera epidemic of 1831-32. But in Egypt, they were particularly very, very deeply felt. The cholera epidemic carried something like 150,000 people. The plague epidemic of 1834 to 35 carried 200,000 people out of a population that was maybe not more than 3 million. The estimates about Cairo and Alexandria, of course, the impact of these epidemics on cities were much larger and heavier than in the countryside. Cairo lost anywhere between one third, I mean, the estimates range between one tenth and one third. Funerals were conducted at a rate of, again, estimates range between 700 to 1,500 funerals a day. So these were very, very heavy epidemics, and I looked at them with a number of questions that I hope I'll be able to share with you today. And I never thought that I would end up living in an epidemic, actually a pandemic myself, and not only living in one, but experiencing the same kinds of feelings that I tried to document in my research, but also be witness to the same kinds of questions, the same kinds of societal debates about science, about politics, about expertise, about the impact on the economy, about religion that the epidemics I studied triggered. And that we're witnessing now in so many countries in the world. And I want to concentrate specifically on one particular kind of response to these epidemics, which is quarantines. And the reason is, again, very much like what we're witnessing now, with, of course, important differences, that in the lack of scientific understanding of what caused the two epidemics I studied, which is plague and cholera, in 1835 and earlier in 1831 in Egypt, the authorities didn't really have much to do or much to rely on as a way to rein in these epidemics, except quarantines. Because as we know, pathogen, the bacillus that caused the cholera and the plague, respectively, were not discovered except much later. Now, let me see. The cholera epidemic was discovered only in 1884. The plague epidemic was discovered 10 years later, even though earlier, by the 1850s, it was already understood that cholera was a waterborne disease, thanks to the discovery of John Snow in London. Those of you who can who go to London, they can actually see the actual pump that he threw. Statistical and cartographical analysis discovered that there is a spot around the particular, there's a particular outbreak concentration of cholera around a certain spot. And when he went to investigate, he discovered that what was common amongst the houses in which the cholera was particularly heavy was a water pump. And it's from there that water was discovered to be the carrier, even though it took another 50 years for the actual bacillus to be discovered by Robert Koch. We see him here on the left in 1884. Now in Egypt, I want to take you to Egypt of the 19th century to try and detect and discover, you know, how these two epidemics, 1831 cholera and then 1834 the plague, were dealt with. And as I said, these huge, very heavy human cost epidemics triggered medical, political, commercial, economic, as well as religious debates. And interestingly, in the scholarship, it is usually the religious debates or the religious question that is typically highlighted. It's not only the scholarship, but also travelers, and we have some particularly detailed accounts, especially of the 1835 epidemic, plague epidemic, by European visitors, and they commented on this. They commented specifically on the Muslim reaction to the measures, the scientific measures that the scientific community was undertaking, and specifically to quarantines. The charge was that Muslims are fatalistic, that Islamic fatalism is hampering the efforts of the scientific community to rein in the epidemic. And they also highlighted the fact that there is a resistance to modern medicine in general, not only quarantines. There's resistance to doctors examining the nude bodies of the Muslim deceased. There is a charge that there is sometimes even physical attacks on doctors. And this is interesting because this positing of Islam as a hindrance to modern science is something that is mentioned with regards to other medical issues, not with regards to epidemics, but smallpox vaccination was also because Egypt started a nationwide smallpox vaccination program as early as the mid-1830s. And the Western observers again would point out the fact that many of the locals resisted the vaccination on religious grounds. And then the other thing that I studied specifically in this book is the supposed Islamic resistance to dissection and postmortem examinations in general. What I would like to argue is that the picture is much more complex than that, and reducing this complex social, economic, political, military picture to some Muslim fanatics resisting enlightened European men, mostly, is too simplistic an account to capture the complexity of the picture. So I want to take you into these complicating and complex pictures, but I also want to point out an important dimension, which is a military dimension. I think if we want to concentrate on one aspect that distinguishes Egypt from other experiments at controlling public in a public hygienic manner, is the preponderance of the military considerations in combating diseases and in actually starting the entire public health establishment in Egypt. Okay, let us then start the picture, the story, not necessarily with 1831, but much earlier. Let's start the story with the situation of public hygiene in Egypt before the 19th century, and specifically under the Ottomans. Those of you who do not know, Egypt had been part of the Ottoman Empire since 1517. But even much earlier, there is a belief that Egypt is actually the cradle of the plague, that plague is endemic to Egypt, that there's something about the climate, there's something about the soil, there's something about the temperature that makes Egypt the cradle of plague. The plague originates from Egypt. And the reason that people say this is that, that many people believed in the 19th century, but even earlier, is that the plague was, in fact, it hit Egypt repeatedly. And the statistics are as follows. Between 1347 and 1895, a little more than 5 centuries, 547 years, out of these 547 years, Egypt was struck by the plague 193 times, with the average of one plague every 9 years. So the plague was something habitual, natural. People took it as a fact of life. In fact, as common as the annual flooding of the Nile. In fact, now we know that there was indeed a connection between the floods and the plague, but not in the way people thought that it was something about the soil or the water, but because usually when there was devastating plague, floods, either very high floods or very low floods, causing destruction to the agricultural sector, causing later on famine in the following year, people's resistance, people's immunity would be decreased and they would become more susceptible to the plague. So there is a connection, but it's not as it's not about something inherent in the soil as such. People, the other important thing to bear in mind, apart from the fact that people took the plague to be an element of nature, something to live with, is the ideas about plague etiology, how it spread, in fact, about health in general and medicine in general. And as in many other parts of the world, people believed in miasmas before the discovery of germs and these bacilli. This is not me. People believe that diseases spread through miasmas. These are effluvia, vapors emanating from the soil, causing the corruption of the air. And people believed from Galenic times, and from Galen and Avicenna, Ibn Sina, that the human body is composed of four amziga, as they called it in Arabic, humors. And when these humors are in balance, then the person would be healthy. And if they go out of sync, then that is really when disease step in. So when the air is corrupted and when people either inhale it or actually touch their skin, that causes the disruption of the vapors and of the humors inside the human body. And that is what causes the onslaught of the disease. We see a particularly elaborate account of this theory. I mean, this is a ubiquitous theory. It's all over the world, but it's specifically in Egypt. Many people, as early as the 11th century, as we see here with this particularly very famous. This is translated to English and edited. So you can, those of you interested, they can Google it and they can find it. It's a particularly elaborate account of the plague. There's a section about the plague in this study by Ali ibn Radwan from Fatimid times. And he describes the quality of the air, the quality of the soil, quality of the water of the Nile, and it's all informed by this miasmatic theory. The last point to mention about how people understood, how the Ottoman authorities approached the plague in Egypt, this plague that kept on visiting the country every 9 years on average. One of the remarkable things, and this is not unique to Egypt, is the lack of any public hygiene measures. There's no preventive medical measures that are taken by the Ottoman authorities in Cairo. What we read in the chronicles, and this is one famous chronicle from the 17th century, the one that I quoted in the chapter that I shared with you, is a fiscal concern. The Ottoman authorities in Istanbul are concerned with the high rate of mortality, which results in land being left vacant. And the question about this is complex. The question is, what do we do with the land whose heirs, with the landlords who die and whose heirs also die, resulting in unclaimed land? Who's going to pay the taxes? Who's going to pay the registration fees of the transference of the title deeds? This is where the Ottoman authorities step in following any outbreak of the plague. They're concerned about the loss of revenue that comes from either the tax base in the agricultural sector or the fees that are paid in the registration of the transference of the title deeds, Hulwan, as it was called. One particular aspect that I thought was fascinating is mentioned in this particular book, and it is the order issued in 1641, I think, by the Ottoman authorities to the local governor of Egypt to order the religious courts to suspend the division of the inheritance because it's just so messy and the heirs themselves have died. The term that is used is a fascinating term, is akashf al amwat. And by this term was meant at that time the registration of the legacies of the deceased in the Sharia courts. Now that the heirs themselves are dead, so there's no point in going through this procedure that is a habitual procedure. When anybody dies, the inheritance, the legacy has to be divided according to Islamic law. What we will see in, I hope not too many minutes, that by the middle of the 19th century, this term, al-kashf al-amwat, had acquired the modern meaning that we now understand, which is post-mortem examination. And this is one of the many fascinating transformations in language, being the result of the appearance of this sophisticated public health means that I'll talk about in a minute. Throughout the Ottoman period, we do not see any quarantines. The quarantines are introduced by the French when they come in Egypt in 1798, and specifically when they launch the second stage of their campaign in the East, which is the invasion of Syria. As we know, Napoleon took his troops and from Cairo, from Egypt, marched on to Syria, besieged Acre, and could not take it in 1799. One of the main reasons was the plague. There were 50 to 60 fatalities per day in his army, and it is this spread of the plague throughout the army in Syria that prompted the authorities back in Egypt, which is where the army is based, cut off from the mainland in France because the British had destroyed the fleet. So Egypt becomes very important. The French are very alarmed if the plague spreads to Egypt, and that is when they start this unprecedented policies of quarantines in Egypt. And I have a long quote. It's military regulations. The heads of the neighborhoods are supposed to go and report the outbreak of any plague case and report the house. The house is immediately quarantined, and anybody who hides or is negligent in reporting cases of plague will be punished by death. So it's a very serious measure, and it's reported extensively by the famous chronicler Gaberti in complicated terms. He agrees that some of these measures are useful, especially when they are coupled with what he considers to be scientific measures, like airing the belongings of the disease of the patients in sunlight. He thinks this is good, but he opposes what is the military measures with which the quarantines are imposed. He's opposed to the fact that families are broken down when people are snatched out of their homes and sent to lazarettos at the edge of the city. He thinks that families are supposed to take care of the sick. And he's very concerned by this unprecedented encroachment by the state in what he considers to be private life. Now, these policies were of quarantines were expanded or repeated by the ruler who took over in Egypt, Mehmed Ali, who took over in 1805. This guy ruled for a very long period, as you can see, nearly half a century. And it's very important when we understand him to understand that he is more than one person, that he has evolved over this half century. And that applies to his quarantine measures as much as anything else. Mehmed Ali believed in quarantines to a dogmatic degree. I think he was also, we don't think he was hypochondriac, but he was very, very alarmed by plague. He was terrified of the plague. And the plague, as I said, visited Egypt once every 9 years on average in Ottoman times, between 1800 and 1848. There are 22 plague outbreaks in Egypt. Not as devastating as the 1834-35 one, but there are small outbreaks, and he's very alarmed by them, and he imposes quarantines. But interestingly, he imposes quarantines on his palace, on his family, on his harem, and his extended family, wherever that family is. There's a famous description of a particular quarantine that he imposed in Giza in 1813. It's famous because Gaberti, that famous chronicler, writes a very detailed account of it, and you can read it in English as well as in Arabic. And he's dismissive because Gaberti did not like Mehmed Ali and did not like his encroachment on private life. And he did not like the fact that he told the inhabitants of Giza, the province of Giza, to basically be prepared for a 2-month lockdown or leave the province altogether. 2 months, because that is when he intended to stay in Giza. Why did he intend to stay in Giza? Because Giza is across the river from Cairo, and Cairo had been infected. So he decided to flee Cairo and go and quarantine himself in Giza. Giza, there are villages. So he tells the villagers, you either stay with me and don't leave at all, or leave now and don't come back. And he imposes the quarantine on himself with military measures. But the rest of the country is left unquarantined. The trade that comes to Qusair on the Red Sea or Alexandria and Damietta on the Mediterranean are not subjected to any quarantine measures. This changes in 1820-21 when Mehmed Ali starts building his new army. This is a momentous event in Egyptian history, and this changed everything. Once he had an army, after so many attempts earlier on throughout the 18 teens, trials and error, now he's committing all his resources to the army, he's investing a huge amount of money, and now he's very concerned about these epidemics that can come and devastate his investment. And that is actually why he hired this man. Claude, or Claude Bey, as he's known in Egyptian Arabic, was hired in 1825 to take care of the military needs of medicine. So he became Hakim Beshi al-Ghadeya, the chief medical officer of the newly founded army. And he established the Qasr al-Aini, initially in Abu Zabal, hospital slash medical school that would have a very important impact on the attempt to control epidemics. Now, as I said, this school was founded in 1827. The army for which it was founded is poised to invade Syria in what would be Mehmed Ali's main military adventure, 1831. Everything is in place. The soldiers have been trained, the officers have been trained, the country is on a war footing, a medical corps is established, and then cholera hits. It came via Mecca, it came with the pilgrims. It was discovered in the summer of 1831 and then hit Cairo and Alexandria in October and November of 1831, ravaged the country throughout the following 7 months. And as I said, within 7 months, something like 150,000 people died. Most of Claude Bey's French and European colleagues fled Egypt, only to discover that cholera had also spread throughout the Mediterranean and hit all European countries. Claude stayed, and that is why he was rewarded by the title of Bey. This is how he became known as Claude Bey. Only 3 years later, the devastating plague epidemic. Interestingly, as I said, the main measure to deal with these epidemics that Mehmed Ali insisted on was quarantines. Now, the quarantines are imposed on Egypt as Egypt. So all ports are to have quarantine checkpoints. Cities are to be surrounded with cordon sanitaire, if possible, before to try to forestall the possibility of infected people entering. This failed. So quarantine quarters, I mean, certain quarters were quarantined, houses were quarantined, lazarettes were established, and the new medical establishment is racing from one case to the other to identify, study, sometimes study in a clinical way, the nature of, through autopsies, the nature of the particular disease, whether it is cholera or the plague. It is then that we, especially in the December of 1834, with the very stringent quarantine measures, that we see the ulama of Alexandria, the religious scholars of Alexandria, getting together and writing a petition against these measures. This is a very bold act of defiance to Mehmed Ali and his authorities. And as I've shown you in the chapter, these are the verses of the Quran that they marshaled for them. Basically, this is what you're doing will not change what has been ordained. This is a unprecedented measures we are opposed to. We're opposed to using quicklime on the bodies of the deceased. We're opposed post-mortem examinations. We're opposed to European doctors examining Muslim bodies. This is what European observers have written about the opposition. I have tried to go into the details of this petition to try, of course, the petition itself, I cannot find it except in the Egyptian, in the British archives. So this is a British consul general translating what he considered to be a religiously mounted opposition to Mehmed Ali and his measures. I did find Mehmed Ali's response to many of these, to this petition. And the response cited this particular verse from the Quran and told his officials in Alexandria and elsewhere to use it if people tell them that we are doing something un-Islamic. And he said, we're opposed to group prayers, people who come together to supplicate to God in what is known in Islamic Sharia term, Salat al-Qunut, is forbidden. He did not close down mosques, but he prevented communal prayers for the purpose of supplicating to God to lift the pestilence. And he said, if you want to pray, pray in your home. Groups are not to be gathered. And we are not using quicklime, we are not having mass graves, we are not burying people without putting them in shrouds, but every case will be examined and quarantines will be imposed. And he did indeed fire many of his public health officials who did not believe in quarantines. So this brings me to what I really want to argue. Islam is not the issue here. What we are dealing with is a much more complicating and complex picture. And the complication comes from the following facts. That the scientific community itself is very divided. It is divided in Egypt as much as elsewhere in the world. It is divided between those who believed in contagion in general and those who, as they were called, anti-contagionists. With regards to plague in particular, there are those who believe that the plague is contagious and those who believed vehemently that it wasn't. Interestingly, Klo, the chief physical medical advisor to Klo Bey, to Mehmed Ali, was an anti-contagionist. He believed that plague is not to be, it was not contagious at all. And as such, he never really deeply believed in quarantines. Because quarantines, if you believe that the plague does not spread through direct contact, but through the air, there's no point in imposing quarantines. This opinion, he was dogmatic about it as much as Mehmed Ali was dogmatic of the opposing opinion. And we see, for example, here two accounts written. I'm sorry, the one on the left is not very clear. This is actually Klo Bey's famous treatise on the plague, published in 1840, just a year before. A doctor, a French doctor in Egypt, working for him, believed the opposite. Boulard believed that, on the contrary, plague was contagious. So the medical establishment in Egypt, both the French as well as the local newly trained Arabic-speaking Egyptian medical officers, were divided. And interestingly, regardless of this scientific division, Mehmed Ali was deeply committed to quarantines. He did not understand the scientific basis for it or for the plague or the cholera for that matter, but he knew from experience that quarantines are effective. Now, interestingly, in his French publications, Clos, and in his English, he has a fascinating, and I'm sorry, I didn't bring you the picture of it, there's a fascinating article that he published in The Lancet, one of the first issues of The Lancet, 1832. He published a letter in which he started, this is 8 years later, what we see here on the left, but he started his campaign against quarantines in this letter in English, in which he said, I will not rest before seeing this barbarous, vexatious policy of quarantines being lifted. It's ineffective, it's unscientific, plague is not contagious. This is his publications in English. In his capacity as chief medical advisor to the army, he had to obey his patron's orders and impose quarantines. And in his Arabic publications, he advised fervently for quarantines. We see this, for example, here in one of the first publications of the Bulaq Press was medical publications. And this is a book that, a booklet of only 15 pages long. And we see, as you can see here on the left, so Tanbih fi ma yakhuss at-ta'un, and it has fascinating accounts of actually how to impose quarantines, very much like what we're doing now, about personal hygiene, washing hands, but also adding fumigating letters, what do you do with shoes, what do you do with food items, what do you do with clothes, how do you allow fresh air to enter homes, what I found is this line here, وَعْلَمْ أَنَّ الطَّعُونَ مِنْ حَيْثُ أَنَّهُ فِي رَأْيِ الْعَامِ مَعْدُود مِنَ الْأَمْرَاضِ الْمُعْدِيَةِ أَعْنِي الَّتِي تَسْرِي بِمُوَسَطَةِ الْمُلَامَسَةِ. So he's saying things that is contrary to what he believes. He says, I know that public opinion, the majority of people believe that it is contagious. Accordingly, you have to do these quarantine measures. This is not what he believed. This is what he was forced to do. This is just an example of the divisions, very similar to the divisions that we're seeing now. The scientific community, in the wake of a new disease, they still don't know how to combat it. They still don't know how it spreads. This is to say nothing about the very strong pressure from the commercial community in Alexandria to open up. Again, very similar to what we're seeing now. There's very strong pressure from the consuls. Many of them are themselves commercial representatives of the different European nations to lift the quarantines. Of course, chief among them was the British consul and his many medical advisors. The last thing I would say is a very interesting debate that I followed between Clos in with his students in Cairo and a quarantine board that was established in the wake of the 1831 cholera epidemic, whose purpose was to impose quarantines. These are European advisors that Mehmed Ali told them to establish this council. So there were basically two medical councils in Egypt, one in Alexandria and one in Cairo. I don't want to go into these details. I just want to say that the Europeans themselves not only are scientifically divided, but they are also divided about the public hygiene measures. Should the doctors that Egypt have, should the medical establishment that Egypt has in its embryonic stages be geared towards uplifting and maintaining quarantines, or should they be used to improve the health standards of the population at large? One of the most fascinating aspects of Clos, a very complex person, is that He did not believe in quarantines, and he believed that our resources, the resources he had under his hands, should be used to spread and build a public hygiene infrastructure for the entire country, rather than to be limited to simply protect a colonial enclave in Alexandria or to impose quarantines on small cities or locations here and there. And this, at this point, he shared it with his patron. Both had a deep commitment for the need for demographic growth. Muhammad Ali was deeply concerned that Egypt is underpopulated. He wanted more people because more people meant a larger tax base. I'm coming to my conclusion in a minute, so bear with me for another 2 minutes. And it is because of this that Klopp Bey fought this Alexandria board and insisted on using the embryonic health infrastructure to serve the country at large, including the countryside. He won that battle after 1841, when Muhammad Ali had finally won his confrontation with the Sultan. And hence, there's no need for such a large army. The army is disbanded, is demobilized. And as a result, hundreds of doctors are suddenly made available to Klopp Bey. He said, with these doctors, we can now establish a nationwide public health system, opening free public health clinics in the cities and in the countryside, that had a huge impact in really improving the health conditions of Egyptians at large. The last thing I would say is how significant this measure was, changing the nature of Egypt really, and specifically allowing the authorities to have a fantastic access to demographic statistics, vital statistics. So it is no wonder that Muhammad Ali in 1847 finally manages to fulfill a dream he had always wanted, a dream he had always had, which is to have a census. A census that would count individuals rather than households. And that had changed the nature of the state in Egypt and the nature of the relationship between states, the state and individuals. Here is the census. This is the first census. There are 7,000 registers of this census preserved in the Egyptian National Archives. And what we see here is a typical, this is the first page of the census of a particular province in Rabea in the Delta. What we see here are individuals. This is the head of the household, and these are individuals, including women, children, slaves, the handicapped, conscripted soldiers, foreigners, including the households of European consuls who are supposedly protected by the capitulations. Everybody is to be counted, and it is this fantastic order of how to count people that is truly significant. And this culminates much later in many, many accounts. Now the authorities have statistics at the fingertips, which is exactly what we're doing now. This is how you can detect epidemics. This is the statistics of Cairo from 1874 and the previous 2 years. Broken down by males and females, adults and children, and every quarter. This is a fantastic state. A state that can count individuals in this way is a phenomenally modern state. But for our purposes, it is a state that can, in a sense, have, in addition to quarantines, something else. It has maps and it has statistics. And between these two things, demographic statistics and cartography, they can actually go after epidemics, even if they don't know the pathogen of the disease. And I will end with this piece of paper. This is no longer larger than than this. It's a very, I mean, I found hundreds of these small, they are burial certificates, and they're not burial certificates. They are daily accounts by the Hakim Bashi here, that is the chief doctor of a neighborhood, accounting for the people who had died in his neighborhood. This is a particular day, 25th of Shawwal, 1267. And he says, Aisha and Na'ma and Fatuma and Hassan have died, three women, one man. Their ages are mentioned. This is 6 years, 2 years and 3 months, 7 years. And this is the residency. And this is, he died with typhus, ishal, that is diarrhea, and so on. So in my nearly 15 years working in the Egyptian archives, in which I saw and read firmans by Ottoman sultans and orders by Mehmed Ali and many, many fascinating statistical accounts by the state, I, for myself, consider this small piece of paper to be the single most significant shred of paper that I found in the archives, because this is a modern state, a state that can count individuals in this way and identify them in this way, is the quintessential sign of a modern state. This, interestingly, is the new meaning of al-kashf ala al-amwat. Here, kashf. This is a new kashf ala al-amwat, very different from the old kashf ala al-amwat under the Ottomans, where they were only concerned with fiscal concerns. This is a state that is now concerned not with a simple tax base, but with demography, with people, with the population as such. I think with this I stop, and I'll be willing to receive questions.